I was introduced to the ideas of an artist and architect team who opened my eyes and gave me hope for exactly how extraordinary public art can and should be. They, of course, are not the first or only, but they did make an impression, so much so that I wanted to share their ideas and their work with you. They, of course, are Janet and Dan. They have actually only worked together on one project called Prairie Logic in Kansas City, Missouri in 2012, and they're currently working on something for Fort Worth. However, each has collaborated pretty extensively with other artists, architects, and teams of creative types on public art projects on their own, so they're going to talk about that. Janet Zweig is an artist who lives in Brooklyn, New York, working primarily in the public realm. Her sculpture and books have been exhibited widely, including at the Brooklyn Museum of Art, Exit Art, MoMA, PS1, the Walker Art Center, and Cooper Union. Janet's participatory, audience-activated work has been recognized with awards including the Rome Prize, NEA Fellowships, and residencies at PS1, MoMA, and the McDowell Colony. In addition, she teaches at RISD and at Brown University. Dan is a fellow AIA. He was principal with El Dorado Inc., architecture firm in Kansas City, which he co-founded 19 years ago before very recently, becoming a principal with Draw Architecture and Design, also in Kansas City. Dan graduated in architecture from Tulane University. He has received numerous awards from the AIA and has been recognized for his work in regional and national design journals, having been commissioned by Dwell Magazine and the Kansas City Star to help provide an insider's view of the architectural process to those outside the profession, a skill that I think you'll witness tonight. So without further delay, please join me in welcoming Dan Magin and Janet Zweig.
Start. Can you hear me? Thanks a lot for having us here to kick off the Tuesday evening lecture series. And where's the pointer?
It's not bad.
Okay.
John,
pointer.
Okay, Janet, I get to reset. So I'm going to talk first, and then Janet will talk, and then we'd be happy to answer any questions. It was alluded to earlier. Long story short, started my career here in Kansas City, worked 19 years here until last week when I came on board as a principal at Draw Architecture and Design. So you're getting me in transition. It was really cadres at El Dorado, but really exhilarating to be part of a young firm. And aside from working with my new partner, Dominique Davison, and a talented staff of nine, I get to work with my wife, Carrie, which was a major part of the move. So it's exciting and terrifying and generally pretty neat. So my career thus far has been marked by an interest in two related fields, architecture, rooted in function and program, and art, in many forms, rooted more in poetry than pure function. One of Robert Irwin's disc paintings there. And maybe more than by either pole on its own, I've been hounded by an interest in the mysterious area where the two fields intersect, a space where the definition of architectural function is expanded to include seemingly non-functional things, and where the boundary of art is stretched to include programmed experience. So in recent years, this pursuit of the intersection of art and architecture has acquired a name, creative placemaking, which is kind of an unfortunate name in my mind. There's something about those two words together that seem a little bit at odds with the kind of edgy, wonderful places that have benefited from the kind of thinking I'm talking about. Creative placemaking seems a little too friendly to me, a little too easy, too overtly happy, kind of like a full-scale Mr. Rogers neighborhood. Great public places that inspire me seem to have a bit of edge to them, an edge that amplifies the uniqueness of their physical context. So yeah, warm and welcoming and safe is definitely part of the deal, but so is this in my mind. Somewhere between Mr. Rogers and Lord of the Flies is the sweet spot of public space design. Somewhere between architecture and art. And so just for tonight, I'm going to quit calling it creative placemaking and start calling it forensic make placing and confidently declare myself an expert in this newly created field. So it's funny how Lord of the Flies popped into my head last week as I was searching for a counter to Mr. Rogers. It's my 5-year-old son, Lawson, wearing my pants from 1971 that somehow wound up in a bag and I just found them. But I found my world increasingly influenced by how kids think and act and communicate. Like most kids, he has no filter. I can see the seeds of every conceivable adult emotion and action in his actions. Love, hate, admiration, wonder, boredom, creativity, perversion. It's all there. Tying this train of thought back to make placing, I see the seeds of what I'm talking about in the way kids manipulate their environments. Their instinctual need to make forts and to shift things around based on what's of interest to them at that exact moment. If only we could tap into that combined spirit of discovery and confidence and wonder that kids have, maybe our public realm would be a bit more interesting. So maybe that's a good intro to some of the forts we've been creating in our neighborhood in Kansas City. And as I prepared for this talk and looked at some of the public space projects that I've been involved with, I began to discern a 5-step make-placing process at play. So I'll just kind of go through it real quick. First step, making a great urban place, is to develop a narrative of all the essential goals and constraints and potentials in an urban situation to clarify the need. And then once you have a program in place and an understanding of how the situation, the next step is to really drill down deep and figure out how to become fascinated by it. It's not always easy, but it's always rewarding to do this. This step is all about understanding context on many levels, historical, geological, socioeconomical, and physical. At this point, compelling problems start presenting themselves often, and it's time to start dreaming a bit. This step, which has a lot to do with divergent design, is right out of Design Thinking Playbook, establishing a time when you can explore without a lot of concern about constraints, where really there are no wrong answers. It's at this point when you're really happy you have an artist on your team. So this step is that I just mentioned is the step when Philippe Petit looked up at the World Trade Center in 1974 and just connected the two buildings with his finger. Or when Diller and Scofidio envisioned a cloud you could actually inhabit. The fourth step has to do with taking a deep breath and wading through all of the ideas generated in step 3 and seeing which ones are worth exploring further. This is where most of the impossible ideas get jettisoned ultimately, but not before they've had a chance to exist in the limelight for a while and inform other non-impossible ideas. So just like in design thinking, convergent design is all about focusing and testing and prototyping and corralling all that energy generated during divergent design and compressing it into something hopefully brilliant and achievable. So on a larger scale, convergent design is the step where Diller and Scofidio and HRNA and the rest of that design team contributed to the High Line in New York, vetted this crazy idea and proved you could access the elevated platform at a few strategic areas and that it would generate economic activity and kind of flywheel itself. Or Texas-based, on a much smaller, more improvisational scale, this step is where Amy Cook spray-painted I Love You So Much on the wall of her partner's coffee shop on South Congress in Austin. This small gesture is a good example of the fact that make-placing can involve multiple well-placed millions of dollars or 10 well-placed dollars, provided that the gesture amplifies the spirit of the place in an appropriately wonderful way. And then step 5, the last step, which is to implement. Once a viable idea is in place, this step is all about navigating the often dizzying battlefield of forces that don't want you to succeed for one reason or another, and listening to them and working with them and convincing them otherwise and creating something great for them. So those are the 5 steps, and now I'll switch over and talk about some forensic make-placing examples I've been involved with in the Kansas City area. A similar condition to many American cities, bustling urban center, and then in the early 60s, the interstates were put in. And among other socioeconomic problems they caused, the interstates effectively chopped up the city into these disconnected districts. And this is what Kansas City at its worst feels like to me, this big sweaty hammerlock from a guy that had a meatball sub and 2 PBRs for lunch. It's getting better in recent years. If you were to visit, it's a lot better. But there are still times where you feel really disconnected there. So the first project I'll show is called Pedestrian Strands, and it's a collaboration led by David Dowell at Eldorado and James Woodfill, who's an artist that Eldo has worked with a number of times over the years. The goal was to start stitching the districts together again, one by one, to sort of swoop in like Nacho Libre and liberate the good people of Kansas City from the tyranny of the interstates. So there were 20 interstates, over 20 overpasses in the downtown core. This project deals with four of them, and then Eldorado's also dealt with a couple more bridges that I won't show. Jim and David spent a lot of time exploring how light can be used to enrich both the pedestrian and vehicular experience during the day and at night. Some really great shadow play happens on these bridges. So as far as, and also Jim, when he started off, he documented a lot of patterns that were specific to the view sheds that you actually get from the bridges, with the idea that these patterns are then broadcast back on the guardrail systems. So sort of the imagery for the system in these layers actually emanates from just showing up and paying a lot of attention to what kind of information was on the site visually. So a lot of great light play, a lot of off-the-shelf materials like different gauges of chain link put together, creating layers and really playing with moiré patterns. As far as forensic make placing goes, I would argue that bridges definitely have their place. Sometimes the best places are places that sneak up on you when you least expect it, and that amplify the background hardscape that we take for granted into a kind of a pleasant surprise. So keeping going on the theme of unlikely vehicular make-placing opportunities, when I was at Eldorado, I worked on a couple projects for a parking garage in downtown Kansas City. One was a public art collaboration with Jim Woodfill. I've done probably... Eldorado, throughout the years, has probably done over a dozen projects with Jim, so it's really an artist that we've connected with. So, and the other project is a wayfinding project in the same garage that I'll show you. So I don't know if you've seen this episode of Seinfeld, kind of a classic episode where they spend the entire show looking for Jerry's car, but it ranks as one of the most existentially accurate portrayals of mundane urbanity out there. So we'll look at Pulse first. Which exists in the garage I showed you earlier in that picture. Clarifying that the need here had to do with stress relief, mainly. Hundreds of stressed-out people showed up to this 9-story garage, and we thought they needed a little minute-long break in the grind between parking in a garage and waiting in line to pay a water bill in City Hall. As we dug in, we showed up and really paid attention to what we were experiencing in parking garages and became fascinated with all the lights and signaling and sounds that were communicating various things. And we became interested in this idea that a 9-story garage is basically a mile-long road that's just sort of coiled up on itself. So again, you sort of show up long enough that things that weren't interesting a couple days ago suddenly become very interesting. We focused on the stairwells of the garage, which were open and pretty dramatic, and developed an idea about each floor having its own distinct light array, so that on a micro level inside the garage, you would experience one or two of these arrays at a time, and on a macro level from outside the garage, you would experience all of them together. We also developed a sound component to the project. Each floor had its own pulsing harmonic tone. And the piece is meant to really encourage you to take the stairs where the tones start mixing and turning into more complex mechanical harmonies. Kind of tricking you to get healthy here. So the divergent design phase of this project was about conceptually summarizing how cars and people communicate with each other. And the convergent phase was all about making that summary a compelling visual experience, making sure it passed all the codes and safety and was maintainable and all that stuff. So we fabricated all of the light components and developed a clever little slip joint because parking garages actually expand up to a half an inch as cars come in and leave. Had to make a prototype for this one, and it was a great little project. So hopefully this movie file is going to work. The first part feels a little bit like a snuff film, so apologize for it. Nobody was injured in the making of this video. So this is one of the two sides. That's the harmonic pulsing tone of one floor. And as you enter the stairwell, all the other tones, which are slightly different, start coming together in different harmonic ways. kind of relaxing at times. It's sort of Sunday night in Kansas City, the NPR station plays like Night Tides. I always get a sense like it's Sunday night. So when you enter the stairwell, it actually recognizes you're there and it gets excited and the tone changes a little bit and starts flashing in a slightly different way. And if you go to the very top and just sprint like hell down to the bottom, you can kind of trigger all of them at once and the whole building gets kind of excited. I was here once when a guy that wasn't maybe necessarily too into public art kind of came and he saw me looking and he was like, "What show is this?" I don't know. Anyway, it's much longer. I'll just kind of let it go if I could. Yeah, okay. So that was Pulse. So a couple years after we worked on that, we got a call from the city and they said they were having problems with people getting lost in the garage, just like on Seinfeld, except not funny. So the garage was designed as this cruel double helix design. So basically, if you parked your car and went out and did your thing, came back, couldn't find your car, and you just sort of walked to the next level, you actually went up two levels or down two levels, and you know, five people a day were convinced their car was stolen. So it was a real dramatic. It happened to me once too. So we were hired with to come up with a way to really help people remember where they parked, and we collaborated with a graphic design company and developed this mnemonic system using distinctive faces and names. So is this a forensic make-placing project? Maybe. I'm including it because it brings up the idea that urban areas benefit from functional things that surprise you. In essence, this wayfinding system is a cousin to the bridges, kind of an infrastructural element that you are used to being mundane, but that doesn't have to be. And that enriches the place. So there's Zena and Odell. And there's a little handy key in the elevator cab to help you kind of place where you are. There's little Jake. Guys on one side, ladies on the other, older to the top, younger to the bottom. You can see Pulse in the background. That's where right we're. Okay. Everyone doing good? Kind of relaxed? Good. Gets a little weird here for a second. Now onto a brief but necessary interlude that is tangentially related to forensic make-placing. This is a page from my sketchbook that talks about the premise of an entirely fictional design movement that I invented 7 years ago called Extreme Feng Shui. You start with your normal, boring feng shui there at the upper left, and then you artificially, in this process, artificially amplify the yang, which throws the system out of balance. And then you engorge the yin to create a bigger balance. So extreme feng shui, it's kind of a Texas idea. You know, it's like, why settle for boring feng shui when you can like ramp it up and have Texas feng shui? So I presented this at a Pachacacha night in Kansas City. I think you probably have those here too. And even though I gave the presentation completely deadpan, it was meant to be kind of a fun parody of the talk I'm giving right now, where a blowhard comes up and tosses out multi-step processes and confused ideas. And I talked about how I had worked on these extreme landscape projects in Kansas City and balanced active and passive energies, like prairie landscapes that slowly burned and then regenerated, and golf courses with these friendly little tornadoes that kind of popped up. And it turns out a surprising number of people in the audience believed me. I guess architects are gullible. So I saw people out in the audience kind of nodding their heads and taking notes, and it was really exhilarating. I mentioned we'd been getting involved with animal design and talked about this giant poodle that we, like, there's standard poodles, and then there's a giant poodle that we were creating. And talked about our idea for introducing a series of municipal volcanoes under bridges downtown Kansas City. And the idea here I was exploring was all about extreme community building, that adding elements of danger to their urban environments to encourage citizens to unite in reaction to the threat. And the final extreme feng shui exercise I presented was to release 24 orangutans into downtown Kansas City. And this one got a little scary, because I really got into this one a lot. And I've done these deadpan presentations of fictitious design movements before, and more often than not, I end up talking myself into believing they could actually work a little bit. And even though I was kidding around, in retrospect, the crazy ideas I was proposing are definitely examples of the kind of thinking that happens during the divergent design step I described earlier. You know, artificially create fear and the community will rally, just like they do when natural disasters strike. Extreme feng shui. See? It can work. See, I got a little too into it and talked about how the program was going well and that our breeding program was ahead of schedule and people are again nodding and jotting down notes. But, I mean, it's a crazy idea, right? Huh, I'm not sure. If you think about it, quite a few communities out there have designed convergently and figured out a way to enliven their urban environments. I'm just saying. Didn't really recognize this when I started, but it just occurred to me. And Fort Worth, Kansas City, we only do this once a year, but you guys do it every day. So, I don't know. Even though I'm kidding, it brings up the importance of having some fun and thinking like a kid from time to time, along the lines of thinking of your city as a full-scale fort. So, I had some stuff in here about improv everywhere that actually I took out just in the nature of time, but you might check them out too. They have this great way of injecting lively situations into urban places, and so I just wanted to give them a shout out. This is a sans façon. This is an example of make placing on a temporary scale. It's called Limelight Saturday Night, temporary light installation in downtown Kansas City. And their radical idea that had a little bit of fear in it was to affect a downtown intersection for a night, to basically turn the street lights that everyone had gotten accustomed to, just turn them off and replace them with two theatrical spotlights, creating an oval of bright light on the sidewalk. And Janet knows about sans façon, and she did this great. Like, look these guys up. They're my favorite guys. And then once that happened, to just walk away and that's it, document what happens. And they took dozens of shots that night. That's actually me and my son when he's learning how to walk. And I can just testify that something happened in that circle. Like, there was this intense feeling that was more than I could have... I just actually got the chills. Intense feeling of being there and just being highlighted. Like, for once, you're sort of on stage. Even though I'm on stage now. That was better. But so that's actually the guy on the unicycle. That's the assistant city manager that just kind of showed up and started... No one knew he was a unicyclist, but... So... In my mind, turning off the streetlights on a city block is a distant cousin of releasing orangutans, I'm just saying. So there's an El Dorado project here, Front Street Towers, and it's a couple miles east of downtown. This is the last project I'll show, then turn it over to Janet. So this district is huge, filled with really productive businesses, but because it's located off the beaten path, nobody really knows about it. And we were hired by the city to raise awareness that something interesting was happening here. So we studied the site closely and decided to focus just on one intersection. And didn't collaborate with an artist on this one. We collaborated with this absolutely enormous phallic smokestack for a coal-burning power plant at the end of Front Street there. It's about 15 stories tall. You just can see it from everywhere. It's how you orient yourself in this entire area as to directions. The leaders of the industrial park were touting their resource efficiency, and so they wanted us to try to bring some kind of green measure to this. So we sort of collected sunlight here and kind of created these towers to help mark the place. The PV panels are tied to the grid, so they collect energy. They're south-facing, collect energy all day, and there's a net metering agreement, and that covers the cost of the LEDs, so they're kind of a free light show every night. The body of the towers are made of two different types of cylinders, with the white ones being slightly larger. So the light bounces off the white ones, bounces white light back onto the colored panels, and really helps develop a sense of layering there. It's kind of a nice little shot of them. You can start to see the galvanized steel structure, which seemed really appropriate given the industrial quality of the neighborhood. So another borderline forensic make-placing project, but I would argue that it achieved a lot of the same goals, reading a site deeply, responding with a singular, slightly crazy idea that has been detailed and really worked well. Let's start to see what happens at night. Yeah. So I'm going to turn it over to Janet here in a second, but in the spirit of artistic response to a specific place, I'll close with a story about how the most famous drumbeat in the classic rock era was born. This is John Bonham, and in 1971, Led Zeppelin was recording their fourth album at this manor house called Headley Grange on the right there. And the story goes that one of the roadies set up his drum kit in the three-story entrance hall, and just to make sure that everything was in order before it went into the studio. And to test the drums, the roadie started kind of banging on them and playing them, and something about that three-story space just made this incredible sound, and John Bonham kind of said, "Move!" and pushed him off, and there was just the right amount of reverb to give the drums this deep resonant sound that really hadn't been heard before. All the drums up to this point had been done either out in the open or in a studio. So when you hear this crazy booming famous drum beat and When the Levee Breaks, you're actually hearing a sonic record of that three-story space. And I think the lesson here, even though I'm talking about music, not art, so to speak, has to do with awareness. To always be aware of your location and the potentials that change from hour to hour. I've had the good fortune to connect with a lot of artists and fort makers in Kansas City that remind me of John Bonham. And great artists, be they visual or sculptors or drummers, are great partially because they see things and hear things and make connections that the rest of us aren't really tuned into. So I'll turn it over to my honorary big sister, Janet, now. And she came to Kansas City in 2010 and started drumming in our stairwell. So.
Okay, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to talk about collaborations in general in a lot of my work, but it's been such a pleasure to collaborate with Dan, and I'm so excited to collaborate with him on a project in Fort Worth. And I think this picture kind of says it all. It's like the two of us sort of drunk on trains. This is in Kansas City. In 2012, I got a commission in Kansas City to work on a rooftop in downtown Kansas City. It was such an odd sight. It's actually the rooftop of a parking garage, a six-story parking garage, and this is a before picture. And it is actually a public park or a semi-public park, so you could go up into the elevator and go out there if you wanted to, but here, you know, after a long time in this building looking down, we did see these two people. I don't know what they were doing, maybe playing Frisbee or something, but not many people went there. It was not a really inviting place. So sort of following up with Dan's placemaking or make-placing, I think this was a time when I really felt like the place had to be, you know, the larger place had to be inviting and we had to make this place inviting. I had done that in other places, but I hadn't thought about it in actual urban planning or architectural terms, especially until I met Dan and started working with him. Here's another before picture. And this picture is of Porter Arneal, who's the... I'm talking generally about collaborations today. So Porter Arneal is the public art manager in Kansas City, and he's amazing. And the first collaboration you have when you're a public artist is with the public art manager. On a project, and it's a crucial relationship. I mean, that person, you know, he or she, and Alida Labi is my public art manager here, and she's in the audience. That person shepherds the project through. The person is your liaison, and they help you through many difficulties of all kinds. And it's very important that they... For me, it's very important that that person is someone who trusts me and sort of trusts artists and also someone who I trust. So Porter suggested, I'll just back up again, Porter said, you know, while you're here, you might consider meeting this guy at El Dorado Architects, who like to work with artists. Maybe you'll get along. They also build things. And I have a fabricator in Milwaukee, so I thought, like, why should I do that? And he took me over, and Dan and I really hit it off. And it I don't know how it happened, but we just started working together on this project, and we collaborated completely through the whole project. We had many crazy ideas. We went through a lot of different iterations on it. The first iteration was that I suggested that we just put buffalo up there, and then eventually, we thought, well, a buffalo is kind of big, it'd be dangerous, and what about, this was in discussion with Porter also, what about maybe we're going to have to genetically breed some micro buffalo, so that kind of led to talking about, so this whole joking around and like creativity of joking around was really helpful to the project, I think, because we ultimately came up with, well, what's the analog to a buffalo? And it really was, if I go back, it really was those trains that go through Kansas City is sort of Kansas's buffalo. And we thought, well, what if we put a train car up there? And in fact, ultimately, we did put a train car up there, and we planted a prairie also. This is just after installation, before it was finished and painted. The piece is called Prairie Logic. And the important thing to me about Prairie Logic was that it, as in all my work, is that it had to give it a dynamic aspect, to make it different each time, to make it lively in some way. And so after thinking about how we could make a boxcar dynamic, we went through a lot of different possibilities of people going into it and various things, and finally the idea struck of making it a performance space. And from that's led into some new projects I'm making, where I've done a lot of work with mechanical parts in the past. I'm not going to show you too much of that today, but I suddenly realized, like, oh, people can be the moving parts instead of machines. It was a great revelation. So this is during the opening of it. The prairie had kind of grown up a bit. It's a perforated boxcar. And we had all kinds of music in there. We had a few more programs this past summer. At night it glows. And you can, since it's on the sixth floor of a parking garage and it's surrounded by high rises, you can look down on it and see this little beacon glowing at night. So again, crowds. We put some odd things on the front, and this is to say, these are all the, or many of the people who worked on it, and I always feel that every project is a big collaboration, and I want to give credit to everyone who worked on it, either on a plaque or somewhere. And if you look at this carefully, which we don't quite have time to do, that like a lot of the humor that came through with our collaboration, my collaboration with Dan, came through with this signage of the people who worked on it. Invoked art gods. I kept invoking the art gods. When Dan would get worried, I would say, oh, the art gods are going to take care of it. So I'm going to show a few. I'm going to try to blast through four more projects and give you a sense of the collaborative nature of them. This one, a bit more serious. I was commissioned to make a piece. This is an historic picture of Mellon Park, the garden behind the Mellon Estate in Pittsburgh. This is a little walled garden that was behind the estate in a much larger, now public park. Beautiful little garden. But it had kind of gone to seed, and the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy was going to completely rebuild it, dig it up and replant it, renovate it. I applied for this project in Pittsburgh, and I read the RFQ, request for qualifications, and I read what it was about, but it did not strike me till the panel what it was really about and sort of the gravity of it, because it was very much the private part of it, the private funding part of it, and the fundraising part of it. It was very much about these two people, Joe and Elizabeth Siemens, who are prominent people in Pittsburgh, very loved couple in Pittsburgh. She was, and this is a total coincidence to something Dan showed, she was the scriptwriter for Mr. Rogers. And she also played a part in Mr. Rogers, the postmaster's wife. Does anybody remember that character? And Joe is a filmmaker for Nova, and they're just delightful people, and they've become good friends of mine now. Now, they had a tragedy. They lost a daughter who was also very beloved in Pittsburgh, Annie Siemens, and they had lost her about 8 years before the planning of this garden. And so they wanted the garden to be Annie's garden, which it is now, and they wanted to have a memorial. So they wanted both the landscape architect and the artist to build into the project a memorial in some way while still, and Pittsburgh Office of Public Art really tasked me to also make a piece that was absolutely a public piece, not a private memorial. So that was quite a challenge. I visited a lot. This was the park before. I met a lot of people, and it was actually the first time that I got an idea instantly. Like, I mean, I was there for a week. I had a lot of meetings with friends of Annie's, friends of the family, friends of, various people who lived around the area, looked at the site a lot. And I was at a dinner, and one of Annie's high school former classmates, I said, "Well, what did you guys do for fun?" Or, we were just chatting about her, and she said, "Well, we used to lie in Mellon Park and look up at the stars." And I immediately got an idea. And then the problem was, I'll come back to that. Then the problem was, I was collaborating with this man, Fred Bonsi of Le Quattro Bonsi Landscape Architects, and I was shocked to find that he didn't know that he looks just like William Powell. "Don't you think so?" I asked. I said, "Everyone tells you this, right?" And he said, "No, no one's mentioned it before." I said to Fred, Fred's kind of taciturn, I said, "Fred, I have this idea. I want to put lights in the lawn. I want to put a reflected sky of the moment that Annie was born into the lawn." And he thought, I'm used to people saying no a lot. And he thought, and he was really quiet. And he said, "Well, there's sprinkler heads that come up. We could do that." He's just someone who says yes. And that was great. And so working with him was fantastic. Actually, working with this whole team was fantastic. This was the proposal that I made, the proposal drawing. This is we found a program. Joe Siemens found a program that could actually, called Stargazer, that could find a sky at a given time. So we picked the 150 brightest objects in that sky at that moment. We did a lot of research. We kind of collaborated with this astronomer named Jim Kaler, who told us that stars had many names and had all these different attributes, and we tried to choose one name for each star. And then I wanted the stones to be kind of poetic. Some are scientific, some are translations, and some are just kind of poetic things. And these are some of the drawings of the stones. We placed them three different brightnesses. We had the stones carved. And then I love this picture so much. Like, this is under the ground. It's all fiber optic because we couldn't afford LED at the time. And we worked with this great lighting designer, Hal Hilbisch, and he figured this all out. It's still working great. That's Renee Pichocki, who was the project manager, sort of digging in with it. And there's one of the stones with these little light sticks that we actually custom built in Brooklyn to be rounded because we found the light glowed out better. There is one of the stones in the daytime, which you hardly see them. And at night, at dusk, they start to come on. And there's a plaque that has the name of the piece is the time that she was born and the date and the longitude and latitude of the garden. And that's the sky. And here are some pictures of the garden itself at night. It's become a popular destination for weddings, so it's a really festive place, which makes me happy because it's a very happy place for a memorial. So that's a kind of odd dusk shot. And they revived the fountain. This is the team, of which I am the shortest. And this was just such a great team. There was just a lot of love towards everyone. I think that Joe and Elizabeth kind of caused that to happen. But, you know, it was a big collaboration of Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy, landscape architects, lighting designer, and Office of Public Art. So there's always a big team in public art. Now, I'm going to quickly move on to another project. I was commissioned to make a piece for a light rail station in St. Louis, an area named Maplewood. And this was, you know, turned out to be not a lot of hands-on with the project manager, so I was kind of on my own. I wandered around the area, talked to the city manager, talked to a lot of the city council people. It turned out they were great. So for me, this was a collaboration with the city council of Maplewood. They were really funny and were open to odd ideas, but what they really wanted, they kept saying, we really want you to put our sign up. Put this old movie sign up. And I said, well, I can't really do that. And sometimes people will ask me to do something, and I'll say I can't do it, and then I kind of end up doing it, but in a twisted way or in an odd way that they're not expecting. So, you know, I kept saying no, 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 and then I realized they wanted an identity. Nope, they kept saying nobody knows we're here. So instead of placing something at the light rail station, I put something on an overpass. So I really made it for the city instead of the light rail, but since the public manager wasn't paying any attention, that was okay. And he ends up liking the piece anyway. I don't know what was there, but so I noticed that there were a lot of little bungalows in the area. There were a lot of old people who'd lived there forever and a lot of young people moving in. So there was a real past and future happening in Maplewood. And there were two condemned houses of hoarders, it turns out. And unfortunately, I went into them, and they were slated to be demolished. And I asked the city manager, could I go in them and take pieces out of them for this project? And he said, yeah, sure, we'll ship them to your fabricator in Milwaukee. And another person who just says yes to a totally crazy idea. And so I just, you know, took a lot of stuff out of these materials, out of these two houses. And we ended up making signage, and no, this is not backwards, this is what it looks like, signage out of the houses themselves. So on one side of the bridge, it says Maplewood backwards, made out of the houses, and out of the original houses. And when there's a light, when you pull into Maplewood, you pull up to a light. So this thing's right behind you, and you see it right away in your rearview mirror. So, you know, I was thinking of the past. I was thinking of this is the past of Maplewood, and you're looking back at it. These are the letters. They're channel letters. They did a great job. The AFX did a great job building them. So there's a big collaboration with the fabricator, you know, Adam Brown, who makes stuff for me all the time. He's amazing. So, you know, he put these lights behind them so they glow at night. There's another shot of that. This is the other side. It's like the rich suburbs are on the other side, so it's the renovated Maplewood house. So we renovated the letters in quotes. There's a plaque. It's titled "If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home," and you know, sort of drawings as an homage to the hoarders' houses. And the best part of this project for me was when we were installing, and this happens to be a shot of Adam's down in the lower right, of installing the forward one. But when one lane was closed down, and when we were installing the backward one, people were holding up their cell phones, taking pictures, and shouting, "You're putting your sign up backwards," and which was just great. And then, what even better, local Fox News picked it up, and this guy saying, "We're here at the Maplewood Manchester overpass, and there's something that's turning heads. Yes, it's backwards, but there's a reason. Over to you." And in the studio, they had everything backwards. So, local Fox News in Kansas City. And they even turned this quote from Marshall McLuhan, "We drive into the future using only our rearview mirror," Marshall McLuhan, and they spun it around. So Maplewood wanted attention, and they got it. And, you know, I was just glad that was you know, something that worked for them in that way. How am I doing? Oh, I'm not doing too bad on time. Okay, another way I have often collaborated is getting the content from the people who live in the place. I go to a place like Minnesota. In 2000, I was asked to make a project for the light rail in Minnesota. It was 11 stations of the light rail. There were so many different communities. It went through a Somali community. It went through a Hmong community. It went through suburban, kind of the Mall of America kind of area. And I thought, well, I can't, there's this notion like you're making something for a community. And sometimes you are, like Maplewood, I was. But in this case, what's Minneapolis? You know, I meant to say Minneapolis earlier. How can I get a feeling for Minneapolis on a few visits? So I thought, well, I've done this a few times, I'll let the people who live here tell me. So I cooked up a way of making some pieces, 35 pieces for the light rail, and then I had a contest, this call for entries, and for audio and video shorts. We got so much material. And the themes, it turns out Minnesotans love their cliches. Their two cliches are the weather and courtesy, Minnesota nice. So those were the two themes. And then I said, you know, anyone can send material, singers, bands, comedians. And we got all kinds of, there's a big spoken word tradition. We got all kinds of spoken word, poetry, all kinds of things. So we commissioned, actually, I think over 100. This is just one of my spreadsheets, just to say that I'm the spreadsheet queen. I've shown you two spreadsheets. Now, this is, did we accept the person? It's color-coded in some way. There were many sheets. We were paying $100 per minute. Everything was 90 seconds to 3 minutes long. We were going to pair some people together, sound and video. We got amazing work. And then we installed these pieces, 35 of them. It's 11 different designs. They're video. Some are video, some are audio. If you are at the station, all 89 videos are in each of the kiosks. So this is one kiosk. The piece is called Small Kindnesses, Weather Permitting, so it has a plaque. It says turn the handle, I think it's turn the wheel, something. And you turn that wheel and the little windshield wiper wipes the inside of the glass and then the next video starts. So if you're waiting at the train, if you go there every day at 9 a.m., you know, people have told me, over the 10 years, I've gone to the same station and I haven't seen the same one twice. And it looks like the gizmos are really cool in these photographs, but it's actually what compels people are the videos and the audios, because we curated them really well. It was great material. There are really talented people there, as there are in Fort Worth. So this is one called Hit the Bell. It's just an audio piece, so there might be someone singing or someone reading a poem, and everyone is identified after they either say their name or their name is on the video. Here's another video, Yank the Handle, Thanks. Video kiosk. Open the curtains, please. Here's a spoken word artist. And you can see they're numbered, so it's Small Kindnesses, Weather Permitting, and then that has a number. This is an audio one, but it's a snow globe. Sometimes these lambs come loose in there from their moorings, because people really play with these a lot. There's another one. You can see the context. This is a government station. Pick up the phone. It's an audio piece. There's a pinball piece. This was the first one I thought of because I was looking at my doorbell in Brooklyn, and it looked like I took the cover off, and it looked like this. So this is an audio piece, but you ring the bell. It goes ding dong, and then it says ring the bell and see. So you look through that little hole. It's lighted, and you're freezing in Minnesota, and you see this. And then there's a Thanks a Million machine. That's also an audio piece. And kids love them. They get like overused. They get used too much. So one of the issues for a lot for this kind of piece is maintenance. And this person, Joe Scala, I met him. I think I have about three more minutes. Is that fine? He was unemployed at the time in 2004 when we installed, and he loved trains. I said, you know, there's been no maintenance put in place for this. I don't know how I'm going to find out. You know, I have people to fix things, but I won't know if something's broken. And he said, oh, well, I'll just ride the train, the light rail to the 11 stations every week for you. And he's been riding the train every week and giving me a report on each one for 10 years. Really, I love him. And he also got a job with Metro Transit, an office job. So, you know, they saw his worth. Here's one of his reports. It's always Dateline, wherever he happens to be, and then he reports on each of the kiosks. Okay, I'm just going to show you one last piece that was also kind of a crowdsourced piece where the people who lived there gave me the content. I was offered this temporary piece in Columbus, Ohio for their bicentennial. It was a very low-budget piece. We could only visit once. I really wanted to do it, I'll tell you, because I wanted to do a temporary piece. I'd always wanted to, and I still would love to do more temporary pieces, and I loved the project manager for it. So it was a kind of two reasons to take a very low-budget piece. So we only had a short time to see Columbus, you know, a day or two, and my biggest question walking around Columbus, Ohio, was why is it called Columbus? And nobody could answer that question, really. I mean, I've since asked a lot of people why it's called Columbus. I mean, there's some vague answers, but nothing really clear. It's obviously Columbus did not go there, which kind of spurred my thinking. And there is a replica of the Santa Maria on the Scioto River, which you'll hear about in a minute. And there's also a big bronze statue of Christopher Columbus in front of City Hall. There was a big wall. It didn't say this on it, but there was a big wall. This is a huge wall. Those letters are 30 inches tall, across from the State House. So where we're looking is the State House. And I thought, what if I have a writing contest? Since Columbus had a writing tradition, I knew that. James Thurber grew up in Columbus, and there's a place called Thurber House. So what if I have a writing contest and I let the people of Columbus write their own sentence? So I wrote the first three phases, and then I had an online competition where people sent me the next 3 to 5 words, and I and a couple other people chose what was coming next. So it was like an exquisite corpse game in a way, like what we didn't know what would follow. So every 2 weeks something else would go up, so it lasted about 6 months, and then they kept it up for the rest of the year. But here's my beginning of it, Columbus Never, and then for 2 weeks it said Columbus Never Came, and then for 2 weeks it said Columbus Never Came Here But. And then it was just whatever came in. It was really hard to decide because, you know, either nothing made sense or it was... But then there was usually something really odd that just stood out, like this thing. So, you know, we didn't know where it was going to go, but that just made sense. So I'll just click through this since my time is up here, but I'll click through the every 2 weeks of the sentence. Actually, I was hoping someone would say that after that begins with, and it happened. So, thank you very much.
guys want to take questions for a little bit?
Sure, we'd be glad to take questions. No, it's late. We thought someone was going to ask that. Well, we can't really talk about it because we haven't presented it yet to the main. We presented bits of it to various people, but our community group, we haven't presented it to them, so we didn't feel that we could talk about it. But it's going to be really cool. We hope. We think.
Can you say where?
Yeah, that's what.
On Beach Street, all the way north, almost to Keller.
To where?
Almost to Keller. Where is that? Yeah. Beach Street has a little bit of a jog in it, right where Alta Vista hits it, and that's sort of the site that we're focused in at.
Far north.
Could you talk a little bit about both of your interest in temporary pieces and why you think that's important within the public art realm?
Oh, I can. Well, the thing about making something permanent is, first of all, you can take fewer risks because it has to be maintained. So a lot of times people will say made of durable material, granite only, or something like that, which I think, luckily, I've worked with people who've been willing to take a risk of, not a risk, but to understand that you can maintain media pieces, you can maintain, you know, people want media pieces, you can maintain mechanical pieces, and, you know, Prairie Logic, the boxcar, that's, you know, you can think ahead to programming. You know, maybe it'll be programmed 1 year, maybe it won't be programmed the next year, but it has that possibility. So so there's that aspect. So with something temporary, those were vinyl letters in the last piece, so they vinyl letters fall off. And though they didn't, they just hung out for the rest of the year. So they just left them and then finally took it down. But there's that. So you can, and the other reason you can take a lot more risk is that, you know, people, if it's temporary, it's going to come down. So people aren't going to be as, you know, thinking, I don't want this here forever, if anybody objects to it. I haven't had a problem with anyone objecting to anything I've made, but other people have. And I think it gives people like that the chance to make something that, you know, that will, some people are going to love something, some people are going to hate something. You don't always want to make something that everybody's going to like, because maybe it would, there's a possibility for blandness. So I think that making something that's kind of out there, that is only there for a short time, is really great for the public realm. You know, people can gather around it. There can be discourse around what they like, what they hate. You know, that can also be an exciting factor.
Yeah, that Dillard Scofidio cloud building, that was a temporary building. But it's also, I think, nothing's really not temporary. So I know a lot of, having been an architect for 25 years, you think of your buildings as being permanent, but then you visit them over time and they slowly morph and change, and it's no longer your initial image of what the building was or how it would be used. And sometimes it's a great surprise of how it's been adapted, and maybe you thought enough ahead to kind of plan for some of that and have the initial design kind of power what happened in the future. And sometimes it's a real, like, downer shock of a day to realize what they did.
So permanence is kind of an illusion anyway.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
It seems like it has some real philosophical value
to me as well. And I mean, you've touched on that, but that seems important maybe to make that case that permanence isn't an illusion. And in fact, taking risk opens up ideas. And
right.
I mean, also, yeah.
I'm really interested in understanding this sort of an analysis of what the problem is, with problem not being a bad word. Just what do you want to do on a site, and what is trying to find the risk boundary of, like, what's a baseline, solid, non-risky thing to do. Like, I found that once you know that, and then you push it, you know, like another, you can really manage. You can take a risk in a good way, but you feel really good about the amount of risk you're taking. And so I don't know if I'm explaining that right, but I think risk is really important, but not just like, whee! It's sort of like, yeah.
Okay, here and here.
Go ahead.
Well, along those lines, so you're making these things for a public space. You've been commissioned by bureaucrats, maybe. Do you think about who your client is, or do you purposely ignore the client? Because not everybody's going to like what you're doing. You're going to have the entire community saying we like it or we don't. So when you're making it, do you think of it in terms of who's my client, or do you purposely not?
Totally think about who the client is. The trouble is figuring out who the client is.
Right.
So you know, if you're... The thing that brought this to me was, you know, way when I first started, I was asked to do a piece in Phoenix, which I didn't end up choosing to do. But the people said, well, now meet people in the community. And Phoenix is a big place. Like, you know, it's sort of like to say to Fort Worth, if we weren't working in a specific neighborhood in Fort Worth, it would be saying, like, meet people in the community of Fort Worth. Like, who? This homeless guy? This, you know, who? Like, who do you want me to talk to? So a lot of it is, you know, how do you figure out who your client is? Now, with the Far North Fort Worth thing, it's a distinct area. So that's great. With Maplewood especially, it was a smaller area. It's a distinct area. I couldn't talk to everyone in Maplewood by a long shot, but I wandered around. I talked to the city council people. I talked to the city manager. I talked to the guy at the True Hardware store. You know, it's always nice to find a curmudgeon. That we found one in Fort Worth.
Just one?
And it's like just the feeling of... you know, yes, you really, really want to please the client, and then you have to figure out, well, who is it? And, you know, in the end, you kind of, for me, I feel like I usually find it. Smaller situations are much easier than big city situations.
Yeah, for me, I think it just has to do with showing up, just like showing up again and again and again to the point where you're just exquisitely bored and... Only when you really achieve that troughing boredom of just being in a place that it starts to speak to you, I found. Like, it starts to get really interesting. Like, once you bottom out, it starts to get really, really interesting. And, you know, who you think your client or the experiencer might be will often surprise you because you weren't thinking of that when you started.
Yes.
I going back to the beginning, kind of Kansas City, the parking structure that with the light and sound show. And the question that came to my mind immediately was, how much has been added to my parking fee to do this? And the other questions that followed on were, well, and especially in retrospect to what you said a little while ago, well, this obviously isn't temporary. Mm-hmm. And how much? What are the problems with maintenance of this?
I'm not sure how much was added to your parking fee. It was a 1% for art project, so it was about a $225,000 project. And you know, that question might be better suited for the public art administrator of Kansas City of that program, but. As far as maintenance goes, I mean, we worked a lot with the actual system to make sure that it was easily maintainable. So all the light panels are hinged and they go back. And we used LED lights that have a 10-year warranty. And each of the cases was designed by us and fabricated by us. So we had total quality control. And we did a prototype up front and actually installed it in our office. And that's how we sort of sold the job was, come on down and we'll show you how it works. So... It was there in our office pulsing away and flashing, and it's been around for 13 years now, still pulsing and flashing and going. I think it added 4 cents to your ticket. But I'm not saying that flippantly. It probably it has a cost, and then you just have to judge How has it affected in those, you know, 12, 13 years, how many people has it affected in a positive way and given an interesting experience? And does that have a value at all?
So how do you know that metric about how many people have responded to it and whether those responses are negative, positive, middle of the road? How do you know that metric?
We haven't really tracked that as a metric other than just, to be honest, like once you, I don't have a spreadsheet showing like how it was really received years and years past. I do know that a lot of people that when I go, I park there all the time because I go to City Hall, and I see people hanging out in the, you know, specifically hanging out in the stairwell and like wondering what's going on. And it doesn't immediately occur to you that it's art. You're wondering, like, is this something functional that's I should be paying attention to, or maybe not? And why did it just start flashing in a different pattern? What does that mean? And so I think, you know, it asks questions and makes you think a little bit, and there's some value in that.
You know, if you go to the NEA website, there's a they're really into metrics, and there's also something called art plays. They're into metrics of how do you judge the success of art and the success of public art, and there's a lot of information on that for you there. They're working on that.
I would say that Kansas City, if you came to Kansas City, it reminds me a lot of Fort Worth, actually, in many, many weird ways, like for all the way from the relationship between kind of fine art and really kind of high impact art institutions to a thriving grassroots culture to blue collar existence in a past having to deal with cows. I mean, really, it's what Kansas City is all about. It's like that's where they ended and here's where they started and they walked there. But Kansas City and the arts culture in Kansas City, both on a grassroots and institutional level, has really taken off in the last 15 years. And it's something that if you were to ask the mayor and city council and city manager now, you know, what makes us different, they'll say that within 30 seconds, that it has made a huge impact to the success of Kansas City, people actually wanting to come downtown and kind of tap into that energy. So, you know, there's probably some metrics that are involved there. It's just one metric is there's a lot of young people that live there now. I mean, there's a lot of millennials that are coming to live downtown, and it just you know, there are dozens and dozens of public art projects that are contributing to that energy, I think.
Well, no, I agree. I think Kansas City is one of the undiscovered great weekends.
That's true.
Anybody else have a question? Yeah.
Back to the temporary projects, are you seeing more opportunities for that expanding conceptual ephemeral temporary projects?
There's more.
For example, the percent for art programs?
I feel that it's on about to happen, but people are trying to okay, it happens like crazy in private, like Creative Time, Public Art Fund,
right.
GLOW in Santa Monica. That's a temporary project where they spend a ton of money for one night. One all-night thing. And it's so popular. It's thousands and thousands of people come to it. So definitely private. But public, there are some ordinances written where it's just really hard for people to change. But I know that, you know, having gone to the Public Art Network conference, I know a lot of managers are dying to be able to do it because they know that it's programmable. You know, I'm working for the city of Redmond right now, and we're building something, and they went right away. It is a city, but they didn't really have a lot of Redmond, Washington. They didn't have a lot of rules in place. They don't have a public art manager, really. And they went right away for a temporary piece. But the bigger cities where they have, you know, bond money, like Kansas City, is probably more difficult. Maybe Fort Worth. I don't know. They have to rewrite some rules to be able to do that.
Yeah, the city of Dallas is now going to do that, which is, I think, for the first time.
That's great.
Again, it's tied to a bond program, so they're only starting with one or two, maybe.
I've got a great example.
It's expanding.
In Kansas City, there's an organization called the Charlotte Street Foundation, and I'm on the board of that. And there's a program within Charlotte Street called Rocket Grants, and it's funded by Warhol. I mean, just incredible funding from Warhol Foundation. Mm-hmm. And it's been around for 4 years now, and it results in 12 to 15, $8,000 grants to specific artists and art teams that want to do something. So along the lines of the example I always give is like an opera in a laundromat or a photography show in just an unlikely place like a Dunkin' Donuts or an alley or something, but really high impact, high quality projects, and artists can actually make a little money on them. And most of them, all of them are temporary. So it's all about that temporary energy. And it's just one of my favorite programs. It's hugely popular.
Jerry's question is one that you hear a lot with public art, and it's so interesting because I happen to know that Jerry's a docent here and very invested in art and understands the power of art and all of that. And so it's interesting to hear him ask that question, because I think that's maybe part of what fascinated me about the two of you and your project, is that idea that there just needs to be a level of trust. At some point, you have to trust that art does what it does, and it's not always measurable, but the impact is individual, and then, like you said, in Kansas City, it becomes collective, but you almost can't plan for the collective, because then it becomes a design project. It doesn't become art. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to hear, and I'm glad that that was brought up, because that's the reality. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you guys are out there doing things that are not necessarily measurable, are not designed to be measured, but in fact clearly have an impact.
Well, there's the thanks a million thing. That's probably 600,000, I know. Someone in the back.
I was wondering, besides the Public Art Network, and maybe the only public art publication I'm aware of is Public Art Review, right, how else do you stay up to date on new projects and new ways of considering art in the public realm, new people that are entering the field?
I look a lot, actually. I have lists and lists because I teach public art. I have this huge, if you want me to give you the address to it, a web address, I will. I have this huge list of links to organizations all over the world, and especially England and Scandinavia, amazing public art. So I look at that a lot. There's some blogs I look at. It's hard. There aren't organizations in the United States, organizations or publications besides the two that you mentioned. So it's hard. But I think you have to look elsewhere, and you have to just keep up with what's going on. Like Situations in England is really great, and bunch of other organizations, the Fourth Plinth, all kinds of stuff there.
But you have a website that lists them?
I have a website for my students that I give out individually to people who ask me for it, yeah.
Before I forget, I'm hoping my computer is up in the... oh, it is, okay, thumbs up. I've been carrying around this backpack, and it's like losing your wallet. I just keep thinking, where's my...
Anyone else? Kept you a long time?
Okay. Speaking of Public Art Review, they oftentimes really feature and focus public artworks that are tied to social issues. And I'm wondering about how you see, it feels like more and more artists working in the public realm are starting to address issues rather than just solving maybe specific site related issues or concerns or whatever, or creating something site specific that are dealing with bigger issues. Do you see that as being something that's happening more and more?
Absolutely. You know, there are two big conferences, the Creative Times Summit and the Open Engagement Conference. That it's happening, I think, this year. I'm not sure where Open Engagement is happening, but Creative Times Summit has happened in Sweden. It's usually in New York. And there's so many artists now doing... and then there's an organization called The Blade of Grass that funds those kinds of projects. It's very big in public art, but obviously not in municipally funded public art. It feels like all my students are making work like that. It can really go wrong. But when done right, someone like John Rubin in Pittsburgh, he's kind of my hero. He's amazing. Look him up. When done right, it's incredible. I mean, it can create conversation. It can change things. Yeah.
That we probably ought to call it an eye on that, but thank you so much.